George Foote, and we are talking about his duties at the Intelligence Director to the Royal Canadian Air Force in Canada in the late 50s.
That's right. When the Soviets began to fly to across to Canada, we had to send pilots over to help them come through. And they would either, the British maybe took them from Tuchinair Airport to London, and then a Canadian would get on board and come with them and help them go through.
So these are airliners or
No, these are airliners, okay? So I briefed the boys, and I had the cameras for them, and what was needed. So I found out from the analysts what was needed, and then I briefed the boys, and they went, and they brought me the intelligence, and it was passed out. That was one of my, that was a good duty. And then the 408 Squadron, which was based at Rockcliffe.
Mm-hmm. In Ottawa.
In Ottawa. They were doing flights to the north. So the captain and it would come to me, and I would brief them on intelligence we wanted. Like there was a Badger which landed on an ice floe and couldn't get off. And so I briefed them on this, and they went up there and they found the Badger and they flew across it and they took beautiful pictures of it. And that was the first time that they were able to analyze the size, all the dimensions of that aircraft.
What year would that have been, do you recall?
Gee, I don't know. I started there in 58. I guess it was 59, 60, something like that.
So heavy Cold War days?
Yeah, that was in the Cold War days, yeah.
Did the 408 Squadron have an intelligence officer of its own?
Yeah. Sure they did, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Every squadron did. Let's switch it off a second. And then, of course, became the integration of the forces.
Yes.
And so that we didn't have a director of air intelligence anymore, or a director of military or naval, because I did the naval military attaches. They didn't. The military and naval didn't come to me.
Okay.
But under integration, then I became head of attache services. And so I trained the air, the military, and the naval attaches. Basically, I trained those going behind the Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, they had to go around and be briefed by the analysts and everything. Mm-hmm. But I trained them in how to go about getting intelligence. Mm-hmm. I also did their administration abroad, because...
So while they were in Moscow?
While they were in Moscow, they reported to me. That their intelligence came to me, and then I dispersed it.
Interesting.
Yeah. But also, I looked after their accommodation and all that sort of thing.
Did you have a staff?
Yeah, me. But I think there were only seven attaches.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I analyzed all their photography for them, and I was the only one who really corresponded with them. Sometimes I would write a letter and give it to Group Captain Dilworth, or whoever was in charge at the time, and send off under his signature where I wrote it, you know. That's so that the boys didn't feel that they weren't being remembered.
Sure.
We have he now calls himself Colonel, but he was Group Captain Group Captain Miller. It came through my hands, and he went to Prague,
mm-hmm.
Hugh Miller. And he told the president of the Air Force Association, who was a friend of his
yeah.
George was my mentor. See, just like Hans
yes.
in there before, George was my mentor, because I was the original developer of all these schemes.
Yeah, all those techniques.
All those techniques, yeah.
Boy.
People had done this or done that, but they hadn't put it all together.
Yeah. So how long did you work for the RCAF?
11 years.
11 years. So until 60, 70?
So I go back 73, go back 5 years, that's 60, 68, I guess. I retired from there. We had a group captain who'd been in Poland, and he had nearly got caught once. And when he came back, he became my boss. And he said, "George, we've got to stop all these tactics. We can't have this going on, and our boys may be PNG'd." Well, nobody had ever been PNG'd under my control. And so I said, "I can't work for you. If this is the way it's going to be, you know, either I get intelligence or I don't." And at that time, I got a letter saying there's an appointment for in charge of administration of the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development, particularly as there's going to be a reorganization and there's going to be an awful mess of moving and, you know, all over the place. And would I be interested
in working for Indian Affairs and Northern Development?
Would I be interested? That's right. And so I phoned up the secretary, and the departmental secretary is called Bill Mills, and I said, "Look, I need to know something about this. I don't know anything about your department, and I'd like to know more about what's going on the job." And he said, "Well, but I said I can't do it over the phone. Could I come and visit you and find out? Could spend a whole day there." He said, "Do that." So I went and I spent a whole day there with him. And I thought, "Well, this is not too bad." And I said, "Yeah, sure, I will sit the board." Well, they had chosen 9 files out of 81 to sit the board. And the only reason they chose mine was because I had moved an RAF station from Ratmalana to Ngumbo and kept everything going. They picked that up, you see. But then the deputy minister, who was John MacDonald, oddly enough, he said, "Well, look, do you think this guy's going to come in and start telling us what the hell it's all about here?" And so Bill said, "No, I've talked to him. I think he's fine." So we sat the board, and I won the board. And so I left intelligence.
Yeah. Boy, that's...
And that was great. And they made me promise to give them 5 years.
At Diane.
Yeah. So I gave them 5 years.
Yeah.
We got everything done they wanted, and I retired.
Yeah.
And that was the finish of my career.
Of your working?
My working career. Well, we bought a trailer park and built that up in 5 years from 25 trailers to 150, and we sold that. I haven't done it again.
And that was in Trenton or on the Bay of Quinte?
On the Bay of Quinte, yeah.
Do you remember, what was the name of the place?
Mohawk Bay Trailer Park.
Mohawk Bay Trailer Park.
Yeah.
And how long did you run the Mohawk Bay
Trailer Park? 5 years.
Yeah. Now, boy, it's interesting, from running spies to running administration at Northern Affairs, Indian Affairs, then to running a trailer court.
Well, you remember I said, just switch off a second here. You see, it doesn't matter what job you do, if you use the same method of going about it, then you should be able to do it. So, from my experiences, I realized that you have to know what is required completely. I had to know what the analyst wanted. Otherwise, how do I go about it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you know that, then it depends on your desire. You know, do you really want to make a go of this thing? Or is this, you know, just play along? And then if you have that desire, then first of all, you have to set up some policies.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get the policies and then figure out how you're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if those three simple things allow you to do anything.
For flying.
For flying.
Spying.
for administration, for teaching, and for running a trailer park.
Yeah, and sports even.
And sports even.
Decide you want to win.
Yeah, that's right. And how to go about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good, simple lessons.
Yeah.
Now, you speak each year on November 11th. You speak to school groups and to residents of your retirement home. Tell me what Remembrance Day means to you. I can pause here.
I am one of four from my flying training school who lived through that. And you know, at our 60th wedding anniversary, our daughter gave a talk, and she said, I didn't realize until I had read in my dad's story that he was one out of four who lived through the war. And if he hadn't, I wouldn't have a father. For Remembrance Day, the same way, find out what they want.
Yeah.
Want to do it right.
Yeah.
Determine how I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Then do it.
Yeah.
Simple.
Yeah. Remarkable. I read about your Remembrance Day speeches here.
Yeah.
And how highly appreciated they are.
Yeah.
How many military guys, ex-military guys, are living in this building?
Oh, I guess maybe 20, 25.
Yeah.
There's some of the wives are in too.
All the wives?
Yeah. So we're in two, yeah. Yeah. There are only two officers, I think.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, only two officers.
Who's the other officer?
His name is Stan Wilkie. Mm-hmm. And he only arrived 6 months ago, I think, I guess. But there are quite a few, and some of them throw their medals away. Some of them doesn't mean anything at all, because a lot of the boys were in the war, and they wanted to get out as soon as they could.
Yeah.
And to me, it was a career. It was a job, you know.
Yeah.
So my approach to it was entirely different.
Now, you originally joined because you wanted to fly flying boats, the Pan American Clippers.
That's right.
Did you ever want to fly airlines after?
No.
After the war?
No. When I got into administration, I forgot about it. It's only since I knew Alan Robertson, who was in my squadron in 1945, and found about the Air Crew Association and then the Air Force Officers, so that I've got involved in all this again.
Yeah. So your dream of being an airline pilot?
That didn't, because the reason why they had flying boats, because they didn't have any airfields.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any land-based aircraft that could go anywhere.
Yeah.
But a flying boat can go anywhere there's water.
Sure.
So that's why they were a big thing pre-war.
Yeah, yeah.
And then during the war.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I would like to do, if I may.
Yes, of course.
I'd like to bring these few points out. I sort of tried to describe our role previously, but let me put it this way. In 1939-40, our role in the Coastal Command was described as, quote, an unsophisticated harassment of the enemy. Whereas we slowly began in 1941 to get a hold of things. And when we got the Catalina, and we started to get more aircraft. And our role had changed in 1943 to become the most effective weapon against the U-boat in the whole war. And you know, in my research, there were 14 million tons of shipping laying at the bottom of the Atlantic, and 1,049 U-boats had been destroyed. Now, I've seen it written that two-thirds of them were destroyed by aircraft to Coastal Command. Whether this is accurate enough, I wouldn't be able to say. But the Coastal Command was the poor command. We were the last to get radar, and initially that radar was quite primitive. As compared to later, when more emphasis was given to to do that, because it, you know, in his memoirs, in volume 2, page 259, he says, Churchill says, "The only thing that ever really frightened me during the war was the peril of the U-boat." And so we started to get better radar, and then we got the Lee lights, L-E-I-G-H, where we had very sophisticated radar and the optimum bomb sights. And instead of the captain going along and taking a chance of dropping his depth charges just by sight, now we had full control with the captain working and the navigator working and the boy up in the bomb sight working and the radar going.
Yeah.
And then the light coming on and the whole, you know, when they got a periscope. And so that paid great dividends.
Sure.
And another thing was in Churchill's volume 5, page 6, we read, "The Battle of the Atlantic was the dominating factor all through the war." And yet you don't read anything about it. You read about D-Day, you read about this day and that battle and this battle. But ours was a slow slog.
Yeah.
All the time. We were tired, you know. In the 41, we were doing the 24-hour patrols. Later on, they didn't do quite so much because they had Lee lights. So that's more weight on the aircraft, less fuel. But, you know, one was tired.
Yeah.
And you were searching this all the time of daylight hours. You were scanning to see,
yeah,
you know. And the Catalina was so excellent because it had that big blisters.
Sure.
And the boys sat there comfortably and just,
hour after hour after hour.
I didn't tell you about my second trip to Moscow.
Oh, to the Soviet Union.
Yeah. In August, I got the same instructions, go to Invergordon.
1941.
And, of course, things were open. People knew about Leesland there. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, there were four British diplomats and one General Golikov, Colonel General Golikov, G-O-L-I-K-O-V, I guess it would be spelled. And he insisted on sitting in the second pilot seat. I wouldn't let him sit there on takeoff. But then he wanted, I'm going to sit in that seat. And he sat there the whole way. And about midnight, 1 o'clock, one of the crew members said, "Skipper, would you like some hot stew?" And I said, "Yeah, I would, please." So they made some for me on our two-plate hot thing, sent it up to me. And General Golikov, who had a smattering of French, that's the way we talked, he pointed at me, he said, "You know, I want that." So
you
I gave it to him. Yeah, so, and he gave me his sandwiches. He has. So there was the Colonel General eating mutton and veal stew in the dirty, in the lousy, this white gravy, you know. Nourishing, but. And there was the lowly flight lieutenant eating his sandwiches stuffed with caviar. And from that day on, I loved caviar. And there's one other episode in Brixmas.
Actually, tell me how that mission went.
Okay. So we got up there, fine, as usual.
Murmansk.
Yeah. And when I got there...
Archangel.
Yeah. When we got there, there was a message for me. It said, "If you have diplomatic mail, send it to Moscow by hand of officer." So I told my second, Dickie, "I'm going to Moscow, you look after the crew and do that." And I told him, "Look, if I don't come back, here's what you do. And you just take the aircraft and fly home, best you can." So I went on this beautiful white yacht with General Golikov. And then we got on a Russian DC-3. And we flew it about 100 foot across over the treetops all the way to Moscow. Jesus, scared the hell out of me. And so I spent 7 days in Moscow, and with my ukulele, the mission was in what was called the Yugoslavsky Dome, and the Yugoslav Embassy previous.
Yeah.
And looking across the at the Moscow River at the Kremlin and everything with, well, I'll get his name in it. Anyway. I played and sang Dark Eyes in Russian. Ochi chornia, ochi gushnia, ochi krasnia, ipi krasnia, kak lubiu yo vas, kak lubiu yo vas, kak bayuz yo vas, of the dobri chas.
And to put this in perspective, the Germans have invaded Russia at this time.
That's right. They were 4 hours out of Moscow. They never got any further.
And you're playing ukulele.
And I don't know whether they knew I was there. Yeah.
So you spent 7 years.
Sir Stafford Cripps. Sir Stafford Cripps was there. He was the head of the mission.
The British mission?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And another thing, when I was being interviewed by Vice Marshal McDonald for the job in Bricksmith, you know, he heard about this, you know, and he said, well, who was there at the time? And he was always known as Sir Stafford Cripps, Sir Stafford Cripps. So I thought to myself, God, what, don't do this now. And so I said, there was just different cracks. And he laughed like hell. Yeah, that was one of the things I did with my ukulele. They went with me on every flight.
Yeah. So your experience in Moscow, though, here's wartime Moscow. That's an insight that most people would never...
That's right.
Tell me more about...
Well, the government had gone... They were in the interior.
In the Urals.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I was given an interpreter, and I spent 5 days just going around Moscow with him. We went on the underground,
yeah.
And they're beautiful. Marble, some of them, you know. God. And there's a special coach for ladies who are pregnant and everything for them, and everything is done beautifully. And I was on a bus with him one day.
With your...
With my interpreter. And he said, I'll tell you a story about this. He said, you see those three front seats there for ladies who are pregnant? And he said, one day the bus stopped, and a little girl, a young girl, came running across and jumped on the bus and sat in one of the seats. And the bus driver said, look, you get off. Those are only for pregnant ladies. She said, but I am pregnant. So he looked at her and he said, how long have you been pregnant? She said, 15 minutes. So this is what I did. And then they took me to the Aragui restaurant, which is one of the restaurants in Moscow. We were the only two there. This is the one that had the great big fountain in the middle. And we had shashlik. And I'll never forget that. It was just beautiful. It's like shish kebab, you know. And after I got back, after the first trip, I made a broadcast on the BBC about my trip.
Was that right?
Yeah, and they informed my aunt in London, and they informed my mother, and Sue was with my mother and with our daughter at that time. So they were told to listen to this at a certain time, and there I'm broadcasting about my trip to Moscow. And I had the record, but in my, you know, all...
Yeah.
Was an old 78, and I guess he got thrown out with the rest.
Ah.
Yeah.
So what were you saying about Moscow in your BBC broadcast?
Well, I was talking about, there was a, I saw a banner with the Brits and the RAF and the Soviet force, you know, dropping bombs, yeah, the aircraft
together.
Dropping bombs together, yeah. I forget what the writing was on it now. And I told him, you know, about the beautiful underground they had. And I remember what I said so clearly. I said, we went to the Aragui restaurant, and we had shashlik. And I said, boy, was that good. So,
was there a sense of, what was the sense in Moscow with the Germans being 4 hours away?
The lights went out, of course, and but I didn't notice anything special. No. You know, life was going on.
Boy.
Yeah.
Incredible spirit. This
incredible spirit, yeah. Incredible.
Where did your interpreter learn English?
Oh, they have schools.
Oh, yeah.
Tremendous things. They have cities, which are just like an American city, you know, a small town, and you live it. That's the way they teach.
Yeah.
We teach grammar, you know. I spent all that time in university and I couldn't talk much at all.
Yeah.
But it was only when I lived with the Russian emigres that I really, really got it.
Yeah.
I think I told you about that.
Yes.
And there's one other thing that's funny about Brixmas. It was before Brixmas, at the original time, like when Hans was there and there was a naval chap. And apparently at Rostock, there were ships, naval ships, the Soviets. They were having special construction on the deck. And so the naval intelligence told him to go and photograph that because they wanted to know what it was all about. So he went there and he took a whole roll of 36 pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent it in to them because at that time they didn't have anybody to do to develop. And so about a week later he gets a signal, return and re-photograph the ships. This time take the cap off your lens.
Oh, no.
That's the truth. That is the truth. That shows you how unsophisticated it was at that time.
This is with the Leica?
No, this was a little camera, you see. When I got there, they had a East German 20-centimeter lens, which wasn't very good.
20-centimeter or 20-millimeter?
20-centimeter. Well, I had the 40-centimeter, you see. And a 20-centimeter, but the lens itself was not that good.
Yeah,
you know, you can have three cameras the same, but made by different manufacturers,
yeah.
And Leica will give you beautiful pictures. You see, mm-hmm. If only we had the stuff we have now, God, photography would have been a cinch.
Yeah, Cold War would be over sooner.
Cold War would be over sooner. You know.
Did we win the Cold War?
Oh yes, I think so. Yeah, we did win the Cold War, yeah.
By what marker?
By the fact that Stalin died, Gretschko, who had been in East Germany when I was there,
yeah.
He became Minister of Defense, and Gropov, who had been in Budapest with me, he became let me see what year it was. I think. Oh, yeah. Andropov, he went took over the KGB.
Yeah.
From 67 to 82, and then he became party secretary in November 82, and he sort of softened things up.
Yeah.
And then Cherienko came in 82 to 85. And then Gorbachev from March 85. And, of course, he got glasnost, you know. And
there's some talk that Andropov started that.
Oh, yeah, Andropov, because he took the KGB and eased it down slowly and steadily. I liked him. I used to talk to him, you know, always at these...
In Budapest.
In Budapest, yeah, at the National Days.
Yeah.
Oh, I always had a chat with Andropov. And whoever was the Soviet attaché, because, and I might mention, have we got time?
Yes, we've got time.
Okay,
got loads of time now.
Okay, in 1956,
yeah,
I received a signal saying I was to report to Air Ministry immediately for a job. Didn't say what it was. So when I got to Air Ministry, they said, "Look, in 1964." The Soviets invited the British, and the Americans, and the French to the Tushino air display. That was sort of the Cold War is gone, okay, pretty well, you know. And or at least it hadn't heated up. I'm sorry, it really hadn't got started. It was sort of trying to soften, and. So the British were retaliating, and they had invited the Soviets to come. So
to Farnborough.
To Farnborough Air Display, right? So I was to be their escorting officer for 2 weeks around England. And we started off living in the Savoy Hotel. And I think I'm the only Air Force officer that ever lived in the Savoy on the government. Anyway, I went out to meet the plane, and here we have... the commander in chief of Soviet aviation, as he, because the civils came under too during the war. Yeah. Commander in chief of Soviet aviation, Glavno Komandujushchi, Glavny Marshal Zhigarev, the commander in chief, Chief Marshal Zhigarev, Mikoyan. Okay?
Aircraft manufacturer.
Kuznetsov. He's the one who designed the contra-rotating propellers for the Bear aircraft that used to fly to Cuba with the missiles. Right. And about five or six others. So I escorted them, and I looked after their meals, and I, half the time I was doing interpreting for them. I spent 2 weeks with them.
When you say you looked after their meals?
Yeah, sure. In the Savoy, they couldn't order their meals. They couldn't speak English.
Oh, so you're talking...
So I ordered one meal for... The chef used to come to me first thing in the morning and say, look, this is what we got. So I ordered everything that I liked. So, you see, my contacts with the Soviets were quite good. They were quite spread for a lot of people. Yeah. You know, Grishko Andropov, Marshal Zhigarev, Mikoyan. Yeah. And then when they came to Canada... I think it was 62, on a similar reciprocity.
Yeah.